This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome, and thank you for listening. I'm Joel Hilliker. Jerusalem is on our minds these days. There's a lot happening in the land of Israel in the news, with an election coming up and a very real threat from Iran heating up. There's also a lot happening under the soil as archaeological finds continue to reveal Jerusalem's ancient past. Our editor-in-chief is going to be traveling over there within a few days and looking at how we may expand our work in Jerusalem. So I'd like to start our program with a Jerusalem-themed story. A recent article in the German newspaper Spiegel talked about biblical archaeology, and it made some pretty outrageous claims, even calling the digging up of the past in and around Jerusalem dangerous. We're going to talk to Josue Michels, our on-staff German speaker, who translated the article and wrote about it on thetrumpet.com, and also Chris Eames. He's on staff at our sister website, Watch Jerusalem, and contributes to The Trumpet as well. And he's served on several archaeological digs in that city. And we're going to talk to them to evaluate these claims by this German magazine. In our second segment, we're going to look at some disturbing news coming out of China, showing just how authoritarian that nation has become under President Xi Jinping. We'll hear a report from Jeremiah Jacques about this. Then we'll switch gears and talk about happiness. Everyone wants to be happy. People have been searching for how to be happy throughout history, but we often fail to achieve it. And often the way we try to pursue it only brings more anxiety, emptiness, and other problems, including financial problems. Holistic nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian has been thinking about this lately, and he's been forcing himself to smile more. He's going to share 7 solid points on how to increase the happiness in your life. And I'll finish the program today by giving you some sound biblical advice on how to get your finances in order. We'll begin, though, by talking about biblical archaeology. We have here in the studio trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Erica.
And also via Skype from our office in Britain, Chris Eames.
Good to be here. Hello.
It's good to have you, Chris. So I'll start with you, Josue. You actually are working on an article here that will go on the Trumpet site, Spiegel Attacks Biblical Archaeology. And maybe you could just summarize this article that you found from this German language newspaper. What is Spiegel saying about biblical archaeology?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hilliker. So the article is entitled King, Prophets, Legends, the Historical Truth about the Heroes of the Bible. How much about it is the truth, we will actually find out a little bit later. But I think before we get into the specifics of what they are actually talking about, I just want to give a brief overview of where they are coming from. So Spiegel is the largest circulated, most widely circulated magazine in Germany, and arguably also the most prestigious publication there. Therefore, I also read it quite often, and most of the analysis is quite solid. But they don't usually talk a lot about archaeology, and surely not about biblical archaeology. Now, it's interesting why they're bringing that up. And I think the most revealing statement is from the author itself. And he says, the name of the author is Dietmar Pieper. And he says, many Israelis see the Bible as a kind of land register that justifies their territorial claims today. The resulting conflict are nowhere as clearly seen as in Jerusalem, where the so-called City of David is excavated south of the Temple Mount. So we see here why they're writing about it. It's more than just an archaeological topic. It has political significance. It has significance for the whole Middle East and the conflicts there.
They're viewing biblical archaeology as essentially a pretense that the Jews are using to say we belong in this land.
Yes, they believe the whole Bible, in a sense, has been written to make those territorial claims and to portray the Jewish people as a greater people with more rights than they usually have through their political conquest.
So the Bible itself was actually written in order to make the Jews' claims today more credible.
There were some finds that they can't deny anymore, like King David has been proven to have existed. So they say the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, they are known to have existed. But anything before that was made up. And this leads them also to say that King David also made history up. And part of the Bible is made up because of that he already could make political gains.
So what's interesting, we've talked quite a lot about just how much the archaeological work that's being done in Jerusalem is verifying the Bible. They're saying that they're begrudgingly acknowledging that some of these finds are supporting what is written in the Bible. But essentially, they're saying if there's not, I would imagine that there's a certain amount of skepticism about some of those finds, but they're just saying that most of the Bible is just fiction, that it's a myth. And yet here is science that is proving piece by piece the fact that it is not a myth, that it's actually quite a reliable historical record. So this the evidence that they're looking at here really is flying in the face of some of these claims that they're making.
That's right, and I think that's a large reason why they have a cover story on this. And the cover story is more than 5,600 words long. They're basically trying to show that, yes, there is archaeological evidence, but look at it exactly from the perspective they're trying to prove. The Jewish people are trying to use archaeology to justify their territorial claims. So they want to show that, yes, you can see there are evidence unearthed, but they just try to portray us as evidence, basing it on a false narrative to make their own territorial claims. So they're saying all that archaeology is based on a bias from where they're digging.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I guess you read Josue's translation of this article. Maybe you could just talk about some of the specific claims that were made by Spiegel that you know to be false.
Okay, sure. I'll say off the bat that it was, in some ways, it was a pretty unsurprising or unoriginal article, because a few days earlier, National Geographic came out with a similar reading piece. A few months earlier, Haaretz came out with a similar reading piece. And then before that, the New York Times. So in that sense, it kind of went along the same script that Israel's doing these things to try and politicize archaeology. But like you've been talking about, Spiegel took a slightly different tone with it, which was quite surprising to me, that as Josue said, since King David did exist, that's been proven, his name has been found on the Tel Dan inscription, everything prior was fiction, and David was sort of the first liar, if we can say that, which they essentially do, to make up the earlier stories. So they make quite a number of claims about the archaeology and what has been found in Israel. And a lot of it at best is a bit disingenuous. And then some claims are just outright wrong. The center of the piece, of the debate, is on Jerusalem, the city of David, and Dr. Mazar's discovery there of what she has called the palace of King David. Now, the article paints the picture that actually the dating of this palace isn't solid. It doesn't date necessarily to David's time. It could have been 400 years earlier. They throw out the 400 years there. And that's entirely not true. Dr. Mazar has quite closely pinpointed the date of the palace to the 11th and 10th centuries BCE, fitting right with the time of King David. There's been the claim that she hasn't used carbon dating, which she has used. So a lot of the archaeological debate centers around the city of David, and they try and paint a picture that actually Dr. Mazar is a bit of an extremist with her discovery of the palace and her dating of the palace, and actually most people don't think it is the palace. But that's not actually entirely accurate. So they don't paint a very good picture of Dr. Mazar.
So essentially, all of these things that you're describing here are trying to put things in a light of greater skepticism than it actually exists, or casting doubt on things that actually have been fairly unequivocally proven.
That's right. In the article, they overlook the evidences Dr. Mazar gives for associating her building with the Palace of David. There's a whole lot of proofs Dr. Mazar could have given them and may have given them, but they chose to overlook that in the article and actually pointed people to another archaeologist and his summation of Dr. Mazar's finds. And this other archaeologist hasn't actually led excavations in Jerusalem. Whereas on the other hand, Dr. Mazar, from a child, she's been excavating in Jerusalem. That's kind of her baby, is Jerusalem. So it shows some disingenuous leaning on their part to look to someone who hasn't excavated Jerusalem and for his summation of Dr. Elot Mazar. But it's not just the City of David, though. They paint the Bible with a broad brush in this piece and make claims like, for example, no extra biblical evidence for any of the people and events from Genesis to Judges has been found. And that's categorically false. There's Balaam and Beor. Both of them have been found in inscriptional evidence. There's a whole lot of different laws and corroboratory food types, clothing types that attest to that time period, and a whole lot of events that do as well. And so to paint with a really broad brush saying there's nothing from Genesis to Judges that has been discovered that corroborates that biblical account is really disingenuous, because volumes and volumes of material have been found. Mm-hmm. I mean, just for a tiny example, you've got the fact that the Egyptians fed their slaves leeks and onions. That's been found on an inscription. In the Book of Numbers, the Israelites are longing to return to Egypt where they can eat leeks and onions. Mm-hmm. And so you've got right down to the minutest corroborating evidence. Maybe you don't have more famous names like Abraham. That name hasn't been discovered yet in an inscription, but he led a largely nomadic life. So just to paint with broad brushes that nothing's been found from this period, again, is a bit disingenuous. And to go just back to the time of David, I mean, originally the idea was David was a myth. David didn't exist. And then the Tel Dan Stele was found in 1992. And from that point on, the archaeologists, the minimalists, had to admit that, okay, David did exist. And so this is accepted by Der Spiegel, and they essentially go back to him as the first king of Israel and essentially the first one to make up anything that came before, basically, the time period that came before. And they point to two examples of this, or at least two theories. They say that David began his reign in Hebron, and in order to establish the importance of Hebron, he made up the account that the patriarchs were buried there. Mm. And they kind of throw this out there. They say no evidence can prove this, but there you go. Maybe David made up that the patriarchs were buried there. And then David moved his capital to Jerusalem, and obviously he couldn't take the tombs of the patriarchs with him, so he made up the Ark of the Covenant and brought the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments to Jerusalem.
The way that Dr. Mazar excavates, she will look at the biblical record and essentially assume that what it says is accurate, and then dig accordingly, and using it essentially as a historical document that she can trust. And that approach to her digging has yielded tremendous results, and it's shown that, yes, it can. It affirms the fact that those details are accurate, and the way that Spiegel is talking about it, it's essentially taking the opposite view, that we are going to assume that it is wrong until we have absolute uncontestable evidence that forces us to back away from that view. And so you can see how that kind of an approach would yield all kinds of erroneous conclusions, just because, as we've seen and we've talked about so much, the corroboration is there. The evidence that it is reliable is growing more and more. So just to finish this, you wrote this article, Josue, and you actually talked about the fact that this mindset behind this article, like the attitude toward biblical archaeology and toward Israel, actually has prophetic significance. Maybe you could explain what you mean by that.
As Chris Eames pointed out, many Israeli scientists and archaeologists, they reject a lot of their own history, and that's part of why they want to give up land for peace, and they just don't want to be associated with that history. But it is interesting why Spiegel or Germany is attacking that history too. And it has been pointed out quite often that anytime Germany or Germany's media reports about Israel, they have a certain bias. They portray Israel as the aggressor in the region. And from that standpoint, they also analyze the biblical archaeology. They are assuming that anything they are digging out there is to prove the Jewish political viewpoint to make those territorial claims. Now, that bias causes them to reject a lot of archaeological evidence that's plainly proven, as Chris Eames has pointed out there. So, but if you have such a bias, often you don't just ignore evidence. Sometimes it leads people to destroy evidence. And Germany is known for that, and other people are also known for that. That's why books are burned and the like in history. But there's a specific prophecy that relates to exactly such an outcome, and that's found in Jeremiah 8. Now, we already have seen a lot of archaeological evidence unearthed, including King David's palace, as Chris also pointed out. But a prophecy shows that there will be one more found that really will shock this earth and really push back lots of those naysayers about biblical archaeology, and that will be the tombs of the kings. And those tombs include King David's and King Solomon's tombs, as well as other Jewish kings. Now, when that is unearthed and found, it will be a worldwide sensation, the Bible predicts. But it's also interesting how the events unfold after this discovery comes out. And Jeremiah 8 shows that at that time, and it speaks about the end time as we see in Jeremiah 7, the Holy Roman Empire, which is an empire that has ruled Europe for centuries, will march into Jerusalem and actually destroy the bones of the kings or those tombs. Now, that's exactly where a bias can lead one. Once you can't justify your bias anymore by facts, you go out and you destroy those facts. And there are many other prophecies that relate to that. For example, in Psalm 83 shows a prophecy that speaks also of that bias where Arab nations, and we know Arab nations always seek to destroy Israel, but also Germany seeks to destroy Israel in that prophecy. And other than Arab nations, Germany is Israel's historic enemy. And that prophecy shows that those two groups, a German-led Europe and an alliance of Arab nations, are seeking to destroy Israel. And we're already seeing it in the media. The hostility towards Israel is building. The hostility is growing and growing, and the people are influenced in that way. They see Israel or the Jewish nation in the Middle East as the aggressor, as the problem. And the more the people think that, the more and more they will see them as justified as attacking Israel in the end, just exactly as Bible prophesies they would.
Well, that is an extremely important prophecy, and it's very interesting how you look at those prophecies, and archaeology really does factor into that betrayal that is going to take place there. It's definitely worth studying into more deeply, and we do have more material on that. We've been talking to Josue Michels and Chris Eames, disputing Spiegel's attack on biblical archaeology. Josue and Chris have written an article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. Spiegel attacks biblical archaeology. That should be going up anytime if it's not up there already, but go check it out. And visit our sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il. This website keeps you up to date with the latest archaeological news as well as political and geopolitical news. So it's a wonderful resource that you can use to stay up to date. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Where does authoritarianism take you? History gives a lot of chilling examples, but the world is witnessing quite a shocking example on the world scene today, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
To begin this segment, I'd like to play a clip from a woman named Mirigal Terson.
There were around 60 people in one of the cells where I was held. At night, 15 women would stand up while the rest of us would sleep sideways. And then we would rotate every 2 hours. Some people had not taken a shower in over a year. The guards put a helmet on my shaved head. Each time I was electrocuted, my whole body would shake violently and I could feel the pain in my veins. I thought I would rather die than go through this torture. I begged them to kill me.
That was Mirigal Terson, as I said. She was giving a testimony there to the United States Congress. And she was describing the torture she had suffered while being held in an internment camp. And she went on to say that during her final 3 months, 9 of the women that shared that cell with her died. Their bodies just couldn't take the abuse anymore. And all the while, as they were starving and being tortured and watching their cellmates die, in a tragically Orwellian twist, these women were made to sing songs praising their captors. And here's an important detail. The nightmare that Terson and these other women face didn't happen decades ago in some World War II-era concentration camp that's long since been closed down. It actually happened just months ago in an internment network run by Terson's own national government in China. And these camps are operating right now. Mirigal Terson is an ethnic Uyghur from Xinjiang. Xinjiang is south of Kazakhstan and Mongolia, and it was long contested by the Mongols, the Chinese, and several different Turkic groups. But in the 18th century, China's Qing dynasty brought this region and its people under Chinese control. And ever since, Xinjiang has been an intermittent flashpoint for tensions between Uyghurs like Terson, who are mostly Turkic-speaking Muslims, and the Han Chinese, who are mainly Mandarin-speaking atheists. And they comprise more than 90% of China's total population. The Xinjiang tensions grew considerably more tense throughout the 1990s because the Uyghurs watched as the Kazakhs, the Uzbeks, the Kyrgyz, and other Turkic-speaking Muslim neighbors seceded from the Soviet Union and formed independent nations bearing their names. Many Uyghurs sought to follow suit. They wanted to secede from China and make Xinjiang a sovereign nation as well. But Chinese leaders were bent on keeping Xinjiang locked into what they call the Great Family of Chinese National Territory. The tensions exploded in 2008 when Uyghurs protested Chinese oppression with terrorist bus bombings and attacks on police facilities. Chinese authorities said the violence killed hundreds of people, mainly Han Chinese, and the authorities deployed large numbers of People's Liberation Army soldiers to Xinjiang's largest city, Urumqi. The violent outbursts continued throughout the next few years, and the Chinese Communist Party kept making its grip on Xinjiang tighter and tighter. Then, a new man was appointed leader of China, and he would tighten the Communist Party's grip to a chokehold. When Xi Jinping became Secretary General of the Communist Party in late 2012, he was a relatively obscure personality in Chinese politics. Most experts believed he would lead the nation in the tradition of his most recent predecessors, basically maintaining the status quo. But Xi began almost immediately to confound those forecasts. Rather than keeping the first among equals brand of leadership, followed by his recent predecessors, he embraced a strongman approach. He bypassed state council authorities by creating policy-making party groups, many of which he personally chairs. He took direct control of writing policy on everything from China's economy and international relations to its internet regulations. He waged an anti-corruption campaign, resulting in the arrest or imprisonment of a breathtaking 1.4 million Communist Party members. He disappeared dissidents and hundreds of human rights lawyers in waves of arrests. He also implemented profound military reforms that made him the unchallenged head of China's vast army. In April of 2014, just weeks after knife-wielding Uyghur terrorists killed 31 people and injured 141, Xi made an official visit to Xinjiang. Hours after his departure, a Uyghur bomb tore through a train station, killing 3 and injuring 79. Xi seemed to take the attacks as a direct challenge to his authority and to China's overall stability. He spoke to party leaders in Xinjiang saying, quote, "Build steel walls and iron fortresses. We are waging a people's war on terrorism. Set up nets above and snares below. Cracking down severely on violent terrorist activities must be the focus of our current struggle." Xi's government lost no time making his vision a reality, and the campaign quickly began to extend far beyond a crackdown just on violent terrorist activities. By May of 2015, when Mirigol Tursun was first detained, Xinjiang was being transformed into a state of inescapable surveillance and predictive policing. Cameras were ubiquitous, police checkpoints were everywhere, and there were numerous of what the Chinese government euphemistically calls re-education or vocational training schools. It was in these facilities that Tursun was tortured for months on end. She was detained upon returning to China from Egypt, where her husband lived. Since the Chinese Communist Party views Egypt as a potential radicalization zone, party officials snatched her and abused her until they were convinced that she posed no threat to societal stability. Vast numbers of other Xinjiang residents have suffered similarly for far less. Various sources put the total number of Uyghurs and other Xinjiang Muslims who were detained in the camps last year between 1.1 and 3 million. This is of a total population of just 10 million Uyghurs, which grows to 12 million when the count includes non-Uyghur Muslims, some of whom have also been detained. Xi's government says the purpose of holding these individuals is to educate religious extremism out of their thinking and to teach them Mandarin language and job skills. But evidence from survivors such as Tursun and from two caches of highly classified Communist Party documents that were leaked last year reveal the true goal. Xi Jinping is using his dictatorial powers to perpetuate cultural genocide. Before Xi, the Communist Party portrayed China as a multi-ethnic society that believed in cultural pluralism. In this spirit, it permitted various minority populations certain government-sanctioned expressions of distinction. But Xi is changing that. He's showing himself determined to sinicize Xinjiang and to subdue and assimilate Uyghurs into a monolithic Han culture. One of the highly classified Communist Party documents that was leaked is a transcript of a chilling speech that Xi gave to party leaders in 2014. In part of it, he said, quote, "The organs of dictatorship must be used to subdue the region. Show absolutely no mercy. The weapons of the people's democratic dictatorship must be wielded without hesitation or wavering." End quote. Inside Xinjiang's camps and prisons, it's clear that Chinese agents are implementing those orders. They're forcing detainees to consume alcohol and pork. They're forbidding them to pray or speak their language. They're subjecting those who resist to torture, sexual abuse, forced abortions, sterilization, and even transplanting their organs against their will. The organs of dictatorship. Outside of the camps, Xinjiang has been transformed into the world's most technologically advanced and obtrusive police state. Arabic script and Islamic imagery is being eradicated from businesses and homes, often replaced by pictures of Xi and Communist China's founder, Mao Zedong. And the Communist Party is not only detaining Uyghurs, but they're often replacing them in their own households and in their own beds next to their wives with Han Chinese men. The party is literally breeding Uyghur genes out of Xinjiang. Genocide by father replacement. This and more was confirmed to the world when the party's internal documents were leaked. Yet the leak and the international condemnation that followed doesn't seem to have shaken Xi. He's claimed that the personal testimonies and leaked papers are fabrication and fake news. The Global Times, which his party controls, recently praised Xi's, quote, training centers for their success in turning potential extremists into normal people. While he was using the organs of dictatorship to commit cultural genocide, including cutting organs out of unwilling victims, Xi was also successful in early 2018 in removing the constitutional term limits on his rule. His organs of dictatorship can now continue for the rest of his life. It's clear that this self-justifying and unfathomably powerful Chinese dictator will keep on asserting his will upon the Uyghurs and all of China's 1.4 billion people, and this will result in profound suffering for millions. In the modern age, Xi's immense and almost entirely unchecked powers seem somewhat anomalous. But history is filled with dictators like him. Such men have almost always produced broad-scale abuses of human beings like those now underway in Xinjiang. Give government enough power and this is what happens. Genghis Khan, Vlad the Impaler, Ivan the Terrible, King Leopold II, and Adolf Hitler all used the organs of dictatorship to gruesome effect. Xi's fellow champions of communism are notorious for it. Mongolia's Korlugian Khoibalsan killed tens of thousands of his people. Cambodia's Pol Pot killed almost 2 million of his own people, but they were mere bullies on a playground compared to the Soviet Union's Joseph Stalin, who slaughtered somewhere between 20 and 60 million. And then there was Mao Zedong, Xi's recent predecessor, under whose despotic reign 65 to 75 million Chinese people were starved, tortured, bullied to suicide, or executed as traitors. Over and over again, when a human government is given great amounts of unchecked power, genocide, politicide, repression, and egregious human rights violations are inevitable. This is often because the leaders feel that violence is justified in order to build a better world, and they succeed in selling their vision to supporters. In many cases, it's a matter of leftist utopianist tyrants who believe that the ends justify the means. My vision is noble. My ideals are virtuous. I must use absolute force to quash dissent so my ideals can become reality. I must wield my power pitilessly today to create a beautiful world for tomorrow. When an authoritarian is driven by such thinking, the throat of liberty is slit. Human rights are blindfolded and shot in the street, and rule of law is publicly guillotined. These are all necessary casualties in the pursuit of the larger goal. They are the blood sacrifices that must be offered up to the greater good. And Bible prophecy reveals that Xinjiang is just the beginning. An era that Jesus Christ called the times of the Gentiles in Luke 21 will soon be in full force, and when it is, such authoritarian governments and policies will dominate the world. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written about this fast approaching era in a recent article called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. He explained that the term Gentile can mean any non-Israelite peoples, and he wrote, quote, "While there are many Gentile nations around today, when this prophecy is completely fulfilled, there will be two major powers, one revolving around Russia and China, and the other around Germany." From there, Mr. Fleury specifically mentions the Chinese leadership's egregious abuses of the people in Xinjiang, and shows that it's just one more indication that the world is headed toward those times of the Gentiles. But then Mr. Fleury shows that this trend is connected to the best news we could possibly hear. He writes, "Thankfully, Christ will intervene. He will finally put down the beast-like rulers so they are no longer able to tear apart mankind. Now that is good news. These times of the Gentiles lead directly to the return of Jesus Christ."
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. You know, it's important to look at this, look at what's happening here squarely, not only to see what millions of our fellow human beings are having to endure right now, but also considering just how much this type of thinking, it's the same type of thinking that is motivating a lot of the liberal left in America that's taking hold in America and in other nations today. I think the idea that you can entrust leaders to wield that kind of power it's been proven wrong time after time after time.
That's exactly right. I think it was just last week that one of the figures associated with one of the leading contenders for the Democratic Party nomination was caught on camera by Project Veritas actually defending a lot of what Joseph Stalin did, mm-hmm. and saying that in America today, anyone who fights against the revolution that he and other socialists want to bring in should be treated similarly.
Yeah.
You know, put in gulags, executed in the streets, burned alive, just savage thinking. And he's saying we need that kind of mentality right now so that we can usher in
right.
a leftist utopia. The ends justify the means.
Yeah, he specifically mentioned re-education camps. And if you want to know just how chilling it is to see those in action, you don't have to look back under Joseph Stalin. You don't have to see history. You can look right now at what's happening in China. We do appreciate that report very much. We've been talking to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Chinese authoritarianism. He wrote about this in the February 2020 edition of the Trumpet magazine. Title of that article, China, the Dictator's Fantasy. This issue is a special issue of the Trumpet about the problems associated with human governments, and this really shows one of the most chilling, the troubles with dictatorship. Check it out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Everyone wants to be happy, but how do you achieve it? America's founders said that one of our God-given unalienable rights is the pursuit of happiness. People have been searching for how to be happy throughout history, but true happiness has been greatly misunderstood, and people pursue it in ways that bring anxiety and emptiness and despair. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist and personal trainer, Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello, great to be here.
So why aren't more people happy today?
I don't believe happiness is greatly understood today. It's just something that's been sort of turned on its head, and we pursue it in ways that aren't really good for us, thinking that that's the way to go about it, you know. And they're really just temporary. It's a temporary elation. Like, we may chase something. You know, we might want a new car. We might want another house or something that we don't really need, but we want.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings a temporary happiness. But it's nothing lasting. It's temporary, you know. And as well, a lot of that brings on stress and anxiety and worry, because it's a selfish way to look at ourself rather than other people. And there's also the state of affairs in the world. We're constantly bombarded with catastrophic events as well, you know, earthquakes, economic crises, extreme weather. So a lot of that stuff leads to a state of not feeling well, of not feeling outwardly happy. And, you know, the sobering fact is that if you look at many people, if you walk down the street, we don't even greet each other anymore. Even a greeting is a sense of, hey, how are you doing? You know, here's how I feel, and how are you feeling? How are you? We're asking that question. And people are morose and unsmiling mm-hmm. in general, you know, and most of us don't even notice it anymore. So a lot of that unhappiness then means that people are sliding into compulsive behaviors, into substance abuses, and just character wrecking activities. I mean, it proves it. We're not happy. The statistics show that. And it about 26% of Americans alone, that's, you know, a full quarter, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder. Hmm. That's a shocking statistic. Are we really happy? You know, and it goes deeper than that. One person commits suicide every 40 seconds in the United States. The CDC tells us. So are we happy in general? You know, no, the statistics show that our state of mind is not happiness.
So maybe it's our right to pursue happiness, but we're not going about it the right way. You have some ideas for how to be happy, and you've actually come up with 7 points about this. So let's start to go through these. What's your first point on how to pursue happiness the right way?
Right. So the first point that I have is create the habit of happiness. And full disclosure here, in my past, you know, I've been known as, you know, having the look about me of not that I was unhappy, but I wasn't creating the habit of looking happy. And it really is a happy. And a lot of what we do stems from habits, and we become really good at them, including looking unhappy. You know, the main difference between happy people and miserable people comes down to a simple fact. They're different habits. So we are what we repeatedly do. So if we make happiness a conscious part of our personality, if we see possibilities and joy in situations, you know, instead of negativity, if we practice kindness instead of being hard-hearted, if we practice being compassionate instead of having malice, you know, looking at everything in a negative light, you know, we can be forgiving towards others. We have to look at things through a different lens. Life doesn't have to be negative. I mean, the list is endless, but our effort has to be as well. A good point, you know, is to keep a happiness journal. Now, that might sound hokey, you know, happiness journal. What is that? Well, we all get stagnant in goals and successes, especially happiness. You know, we can put life back into perspective by seeing where we're going with this little journal, which direction to take. And it's sort of a blueprint for the mind. And the amazing part of it just builds so much resilience. And resilience is the key to cultivating a happy life.
So what sorts of things would you write in your happiness journal?
Well, have I smiled today? How many times have I smiled? Have I said hello? You know, have I been kind to somebody? Have I told somebody, you know, that they're doing a good job? I mean, we forget. It's shocking how much we forget.
So it's kind of an inventory, just taking inventory and being aware of, are you really showing happiness? Are you giving to the people around you? Just keeping track of those things. And because if you're not keeping track, you're probably not doing those things.
That is exactly correct. And I'll put it in perspective with overall health. You know, if you're on a diet and you're not keeping a journal, you have no idea what you're doing. So you're going to be eating wrong, and you don't dictate to yourself what you're doing. You can't see what's leading to a bad result.
So what's another point that you would give to someone who's trying to be happy?
Well, another big one in out there is materialism. We either look at ourselves or look at our neighbor. You know, everybody wants something more, as I stated before. We don't need it. I mean, we could be content, and houses used to be a lot smaller. You know, they used to be 1,500 square feet. Now their average is 25 or higher, you know. And if it's more, or if we have more, well, we're going to be substantially happier, we think. You know, but that's not true. That's just a lack of perspective, because most of us have what we need. We just want more. So imagine taking away somebody's cell phone or computer, or getting rid of their satellite TV. You know, it's just an unimaginable scenario for most of us in our affluent society, because surveys show that the more we lose our ability to understand what a real luxury is, you know, we forget that, or they're not necessities. So a necessity means we need it for life and be content with it. A luxury is something we just merely want. Mm-hmm. There's a great book out by Herbert Armstrong called The Seven Laws of Success. And he said that happiness is not material and money is not its source. Just a pithy little statement there and very powerful. It's just a state of mind, he taught, you know, and it explains why people who have so little can still be so happy.
So we've got to ditch the materialism, stop thinking that more things is going to bring more happiness. What's another point that you would give?
Gratefulness.
It's very closely related to the last one.
It is. Leads right into it. Just a nice slide into it. And if you have kids, you know about this one. I mean, we can apply it to ourselves, but especially, you know, the key to happiness is this is a vital principle. Gratitude is a vital principle, because we can get laser focused on materialistic things and we forget to appreciate what we already have. You know, do we have good health? Do we have a roof over our head? Do we have food in the fridge? Basic points we can take for granted. You know, others, these are unimaginable luxuries across the world. Mm-hmm. They might eat once a day, once every 2 days, you know, and they're out freezing, don't have a roof over their head. You know, are we grateful for the things that we do have instead of, you know, thinking about the things that we want? And I think one of the biggest blessings that we have is life itself. You know, everything else is fleeting and it's going to come and go, but the gift of life offers us the privilege and responsibility to respond with gratitude. It just gives us so many opportunities. And studies show that grateful people tend to appreciate the simple things in life much more. They have much less anxiety, you know, and that gratitude then transforms into thanksgiving. It turns routine jobs into joy and it changes opportunities into blessings. So I would say flex your gratitude muscle more.
It's making me happier just to listen to you, Jorg. So this next point, this is a big one, it seems to me. Point number four that you've come up with.
Yes, control emotions. Emotions are a big one. You know, how many times have we witnessed somebody yelling or being moody, complaining, temperamental or rude? There's a lot of that going on. And that's just, those are signs of immature behavior. They're triggered by allowing our emotions rather than considered reason to dominate the mind. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not thinking about what we're really saying or doing. They're really habits that we have. And that starts in the relationship between how we think, how we feel, and therefore how we react. You know, there's a relationship between that. If we have negative, abrasive thoughts all the time, then it's going to make us feel bad and we lash out. And stunningly, the experts tell us, yes, we do have to vent. We have to vent because it's healthy. Well, I'll tell you, if you've ever witnessed somebody just let loose, it doesn't look very healthy. You know, it really doesn't. And so there are experts now that disagree, that say, look, the opposite is actually true. When we repress anger, it causes less stress. And repression isn't bottling it up. That's not what they're saying. They're saying reflect on a negative situation, decide on a reasonable way to respond, and then, you know, execute it in a way that's calm and effective. Think about it. It's more like deflecting it rather than absorbing the negativity. And it's healthier than losing our mind in an argument anytime.
Mm-hmm. All right, the next one that you have for us.
Giving is a big one, because there's a saying, it's more blessed to give than to receive. And boy, we can gloss over that one really easy.
Yeah.
It just loses its meaning if we don't really think about it, because it's not just an arbitrary soundbite. You know, it's not. It's a principle that actually perpetuates good health. So we can give by volunteering, by spending time with somebody, or giving to somebody in need. You know, if we see somebody needs something. And you can also give of yourself by making somebody laugh or giving encouragement. The motivational speaker, Michael Hyatt, I like following him. He's a motivational speaker. And he says, words can block our path, you know, but they can also pave the way to success. And that's true. The more effective what we say to someone, the better our ability to help that person. So we have to think about it, you know. So we're giving of ourselves, and apparently that never gets old, giving,
mm-hmm.
you know. So even if we do it in the identical way, it still gives us that relative pleasure the more we do it. So if you want happiness, spread happiness. That's how it works.
All right. We're bearing down on our last 2 points. We're going to have to do these kind of quick. Point number 6.
Well, show yourself happy. And this is one that I have to fix on myself. Show myself happy, because you can easily have a deadpan face. You're not unhappy, but you're not showing yourself happy. You know, if you have trouble being happy, fake it till you make it. You know, I've said that before, because our minds and bodies are deeply interrelated. Simply smiling attracts people. It makes you more likable. It makes you more approachable. You know, just have a hearty enthusiasm and give them a big old pearly white smile, and it's amazing how people respond to you.
Yeah. All right. And your last point, Jörg Mardian's How to Be Happy top 7 list.
Well, this is the most important, because this is the key variable is trusting God. You know, doing what's right instead of doing what we think is right. Proverbs 16:3 is just such a nice proverb. It says, commit your works unto the Lord, and then your thoughts will be established.
Hmm.
So the previous 6 points, we did the work. You know, they help our behavior change based on getting command of our thoughts. But here the opposite applies, because God says if we act and if we step out and do what he wants, he's going to change our thought pattern, and he's going to provide our happiness. You know, he does the heavy lifting for us instead of us doing the work. And that's just the most beautiful way to bring about an inner peace and to banish worry, stress, and fear, and to just be happy overall.
Well, that's marvelous. It's obvious you put a lot of thought into that list, and there's a lot of substance there. We appreciate that. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about happiness. And he's writing this up into an article for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that there on the website. Thanks for that very much, Jörg. If we do what you said, we should see some pretty happy results in our lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Studies show that a large majority of Americans have money troubles. Much of their despair comes from people being laden with debt, unable to absorb unexpected setbacks. Many people's financial margin for error is so slim that an unexpected expense can pose serious problems, not to mention a major trial like a job loss or a medical emergency. But there are financial principles, sure financial principles, that can help you achieve peace of mind, stability, even prosperity. There's a guide containing these principles that has helped people prosper for thousands of years, even during periods of drought, flood, famine, and war, through the rise and fall of empires. It is the Holy Bible. One important passage found in Proverbs 22, verse 7, warns about the consequences of going into debt. The borrower is servant to the lender. There may be legitimate reasons for occasionally taking out a loan, like purchasing a home or paying for tuition, but far too many people take debt on casually. A person in debt generally has to service it. You have to pay interest on top of the principal. Lenders are only lending because they're making a profit. Their profit is your loss. So a good rule of thumb is not to pay interest on anything that loses value. It's vital to make sure anytime you borrow money, there's a legitimate reason behind your decision. And these instances should be rare. If you already have debt, wage war on it. In most cases, it's better to pay off the higher interest rate debt first, although adjustable rate debt can be dangerous too, since it has the potential to ratchet up depending on the interest rate set by the government. And it's generally a bad idea to extract equity from your home or take out a second mortgage, especially to finance unnecessary purchases. The extra debt could come back to haunt you. Another biblical principle applicable to financial security is found in Proverbs 22:29. See you a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men. No matter how smart you are, you'll never be a success without diligence. That word diligent can mean skillful. It can refer to an expert or a teacher. Becoming an expert or a teacher requires hard work, but the rewards are abundant. Prepare for the highest, most well-paid job you can. Don't be afraid of putting in extra hours. A second job may be required for a time or even night classes. Be creative. Consider all your options. Proverbs 27 says, "Be diligent to know the state of your flocks or whatever occupation you have, and look well to your herds, for riches are not forever." Other proverbs say that poverty comes if you are slothful. Don't assume poverty isn't your fault, though some situations do occur that are beyond our control, but still take responsibility for yourself and for your family. Don't freeload, don't use others or think you're entitled to something. You are accountable for your financial house, not someone else. A third biblical principle found in Proverbs 21:20 says, "A wise man saves treasure while a foolish man spends it up." You should set aside money each paycheck for known future expenses such as vehicle repairs, trips, home renovations. You should also save for the unexpected such as job loss, health problems, repairs, or accidents. A prudent strategy would be to work toward building an emergency fund to cover all your expenses for 6 months. The future can be unpredictable. Saving is a key part of caring for ourselves and our families and being able to provide for the needs of others where we're able. Proverbs 13:22 says, "A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children." The scriptures also caution against get-rich-quick schemes and unethical business practices. Perhaps the most heavily stressed biblical principle regarding healthy finances is to give generously. Giving might seem illogical as a step toward financial stability, but God promises that when you sacrifice and serve others' needs in whatever way you can, you will be rewarded. So give generously to others as your means allow. As your hard work and financial planning provides increase, share that with the less prosperous. Most importantly, give generously back to God. He created all things. He claims the earth and its fullness as His, including all the silver and gold, all the riches. God can make us poor or rich by giving mankind dominion over and allowing us to use His creation. God has essentially made every man and woman His business partner. So keep God as your partner by tithing on your increase, as the scriptures command. When you give God His portion, one-tenth of your income, He shares in your profits and then reinvests even more in you and your ventures. God loves, blesses, and promises to supply the needs of a cheerful giver. You can read that in 2 Corinthians 9, verses 7 through 9. As tithe payers and the wealthiest men of their ages, Abraham, Job, King David, and Solomon all found out that you cannot outgive God. If you want to learn more about the way to have peace of mind in your finances and stability and even prosperity, go to thetrumpet.com, look under the literature tab, and find our booklets, Solve Your Money Troubles and The Financial Law You Can't Afford to Ignore. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Josue Michels, Chris Eames, Jeremiah Jacques, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Friedrich Nietzsche. The advantage of a bad memory is that one enjoys several times the same good things for the first time. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.